And I found myself just sitting here smiling. And and then you asked that question, what's the purpose of curiosity? And my whole being and my gut just went to create joy. But just the aha here, like I'm relearning. Like I know this, I knew this. And the result of that for me right now is joy.
Hi, this is Adina here with today's episode of Courage to be Curious with Adina Tovell. And if you're on video, you are already seeing that this has begun. Like if you're on audio, you're going to have to switch over to video. So you can already see that the party has begun here. This week's episode, and we are in the month of talking about the power of questions. And this theme selected not only because our big theme is curiosity, but also because two of our guests this month are co-authors of Ask Powerful Questions, Create Conversations That Matter. And a couple of weeks ago, you got to experience Will Wise, who was one of the co-authors, and I am sure had a fabulous experience. And now we are so fortunate because both said yes. I mean, I don't know, maybe I did something kooky to kind of get that outcome. I don't know. There might've been a little manipulation in that. I don't know, but so fortunate to get the two separate conversations. And so today's conversation is with Chad Littlefield, and Amy Steindler is here again co-hosting with me in order to have this conversation. And Chad is as dynamic, like he walked on to this podcast and in the first 3 seconds, you could already feel the dynamic energy that he brings with him. And we're also going to talk about one of my favorite topics, which is the neuroscience of curiosity and questions. So we are in for a total treat. So welcome, Amy. Welcome, Chad. So glad to have you both here today.
Thank you. Can you imagine if after that intro, I just started speaking in a really monotone tone for the rest of the time and it was really undynamic? It'd be ironic.
It would get people curious.
I think your cajoling to get me and Will both on was helped by the fact that you have the word curious in the name of your podcast. And I think both Will and I stand in the place, and I imagine you both do too, that we're like living in this place, this world where there is a national curiosity deficit, right? We can just say, hey, Google, and they'll probably answer us and give us an answer and kill that question right away. So anyway, I'm super excited to share. Thanks for the invite. Happy to be here.
You're welcome. And just a little bit on Chad, for those of you who don't know who he is yet, but you will know him really well in the end of an hour or so. In addition to being the co-author with Will of Ask Powerful Questions, Create Conversations That Matter, he is also the Chief Experience Officer, which I love, of We and Me. And as you learned, an organization with the mission to make connection easy. And he is also a global expert on asking questions. So you can see what we have a lot in common here, a lot of synergy between us, but asking questions that build team trust and build connection. TEDx speaker, author, he's creator of We Connect Cards, and he has a fabulous presentation on his YouTube channel. So check out the YouTube channel because Chad brings just a lot of dynamic energy to the teachings that he does there. And it's really fun. So we are going to jump in, and I just want to start out by asking, and Amy, you will find Amy is sort of the funny one here. You and Will kind of play off each other. Amy and I play off with each other. She's the funny one here. But in terms of asking powerful questions, creating conversations that matter, what does creating conversations that matter? What are conversations that matter?
Yeah, that's a really lovely question. I used to do research on seasonal affective disorder in college. I was in the psychology half of that research, but we worked with a meteorologist at Penn State. And so he's like, this is somebody whose job is talking about the weather, which is the characteristic small talk thing. And somewhere in interactions with him, his name was Eugene Claudio, I realized that conversations that matter have nothing to do with the content of the conversation. Conversations that matter have everything to do with the process of how the conversation happens. Meaning, I had some really wonderful conversations about the weather with Eugene, but I wouldn't categorize that as small talk, right? I would have put those in the category of that was a conversation worth having, that really mattered. And I think the reason was I was really genuinely curious. He was excited to share some of his knowledge. We all three, four of us, whenever we were meeting, had an intention toward contribution, right? So we wanted to add and generate something new. We weren't interested in just rehashing something old. There was a certain life to it. So I think the list could go on. And I don't think every single conversation that matters has to have, you know, a checklist of 1,000 ingredients in order to qualify. But I do think that it's it speaks much more to the process. And if there is a conversation happening and there is no curiosity present, I would bet that it would start to lean quickly away from a conversation that actually matters. Because curiosity is kind of like a symptom of caring. If you don't care about what's being talked about, like you have one foot out of the conversation. And so it's unlikely to want to really dive in and explore more.
There's something about what you said that made me think, and then Amy will pop over to you, is I very often hear from people, I hate the shallow conversations. I hate the, you know, coffee table conversations, that there is this sense out there that people can feel the difference qualitatively between a conversation that matters and a conversation that just feels like it's filling space. And so this piece that you're talking about is, what are the attributes of things that move a conversation from something that's just taking up space to something that is generative in some way? And Amy, I think probably from your perspective, you have something you want to add here.
Well, I have something I want to ask, because I love this, you know, this idea that a meaningful conversation, a conversation that matters, is one that generates connection. And I also love this whole idea of working with a meteorologist, because what comes up for me is, you know, our environment has an impact on how we show up. So, Chad, in terms of, you know, creating the environment, creating the conditions for a meaningful conversation, what would you say were the components? You know, what's the weather need to be like for me to really show up?
Yeah. So I am not proud enough to think that I have the right answer to that question. But Will and I have spent a lot of time thinking
about any answer will do.
Yeah. So Will and I have, you know, spent some time thinking about an answer. And it's a bit how the book is actually structured. So if you peek open, ask powerful questions, one of the first things you'll see is this three-dimensional triangle, which I think we call a pyramid. And so you get this pyramid of both mindsets, tools, and skills that I'm sure Will talked about with you when you chatted with him. And so the quick answer to that question, I would refer to that pyramid. And going off that in 30 seconds is, at the very base, you have intention. Priya Parker, who wrote The Art of Gathering, likes to talk about meeting for purpose rather than for time. And I really, really love that. I think if we were to converse for purpose rather than for filling space or filling time, the key ingredient to that would be getting clear about what your intention is and then sharing it with the other person and maybe finding out theirs. So ingredient number one, having an intention, because otherwise, even if that intention is open, right, your intention might be, I would love to be randomly curious for 1 hour, tied to what the result of that random curiosity will be, right? That's a great intention. That could be a lovely intention. And that's how maybe many conversations perhaps go, if there's a curiosity present. But without that intention stated, there isn't quite that like level of purpose established there. So that's number one. Number two is rapport, which Will and I define as a relationship of trust, which doesn't, you know, require a decade to build. But the tool that we teach for that is following your natural, genuine curiosity by asking someone something that you are noticing in your environment, sharing, caring, presenting, et cetera, something that you see with your eyes, hear, or feel being with that person. So you all know all about that, that level. The next one above that is openness, which has two frames of mind. And the angle that I'll hit on this is more has to do with our brain, seeing that part of our intention is to talk about the neuroscience of asking questions in conversations that matter. You know, many people are familiar with the idea of a fight or flight response, or maybe even a fight, flight, or freeze response. And that's where our lizard brain or amygdala kind of flips its lid and takes over. And we're no longer thinking with our lovely giant prefrontal cortex in the top of our head. We are like back to running away from saber-toothed tigers. However, there are no saber-toothed tigers in my neighborhood. And so we're very rarely running from a physical threat necessarily, particularly in conversation, right? In the context of what we're talking about right now. And so I think what I've noticed in conversation is that it's more of a fight, flight, or need to be right response, where there is not an openness to what might happen. It's that like, I have this, and it's not just like, oh, I kind of want to be right. Like, I have this need, this biological drive to be right. And when we're in that place, we cannot be open to possibilities or outcome. And so that limits the scope of our questions, that limits the answers we give to questions, that limits the answers that we get from questions if we don't have an open mind there. So, and the next two quickly, listening. We talk about four different layers or levels of reflective listening, not just the like, oh, so what I'm hearing you say is blank, but a little bit deeper and more nuanced than that. And then at the very tippity top is empathy, which Will and I talk about as not stepping into people's shoes. We would say that Merriam-Webster might disagree with us, but we would say that is sympathy, where you're so wrapped up in somebody else's world, you've lost touch with your own reality. And so I think really good empathy is having one of your feet in their shoes, just kind of imagining like, okay, what would the world be like for them in this conversation right now? And also one of your feet rooted in your own reality and curiosity and understanding of the world, et cetera. So that was a long answer that was intended to be a short answer, but there you go.
Well, but the essence, and I think that pyramid that's in the book, that's really the core of your work is the answer to that. And the journey is learning and developing those skills and those capacities over time. Because yeah, the more we do, the deeper the connection.
And if you're watching as well as listening to, the pyramid looks like this. So everything I just told you, the words that I just walked you through, intention, rapport, openness, listening, and empathy. On the flip side of that pyramid, if you do those really well, right? Those are a little bit like, what do I do with my hands, my brain, my mouth, my ears in conversation? But the flip side, the result, if you can do those really well, is that what's communicated to a person is, hey, I'm willing to know you foundationally. I see you, I hear you, I get you. And ultimately, I'm actually with you. Even if I've just met you, I actually, you feel that I want the best for you in the world. It's like, that's really cool to be in a conversation with somebody. It doesn't matter if they're like cashing you out at the grocery store or one of your, you know, most close friends or mentors. Like, when someone really feels like they want the best for you and they're there to support you, like, that's a cool feeling. It's rare too.
So, you know, it's interesting. I want to start at intention, except that now I'm so compelled and by my curiosity that I need to flip, go to the back end and then come back to the front. But that question of being with you, because in the work I do, a lot of times there's work with couples or there's work, you know, if we're just meeting somebody at a networking event, like in some ways I find it's almost easier to get to through some of those steps because I don't have as much history and investment that I can open. Sometimes, you know, I personally can open more easily to somebody. But the question of when two people who are perhaps in the closest of relationships, whether they're married or they work really closely together, that empathy can be a really hard, sometimes it can become really hard to be with you because I'm so in my experience of being on the other side of you that I have trouble having one foot in understanding you and one foot in my curiosity. Because as you said, I've got maybe one foot in trying to understand you, but the other foot is definitely in some other place here of needing to be right, needing to protect, needing to do all those things. And so I'm curious about, when we get to that empathy level, what have you learned over time is the difference of creating that kind of connection between people we don't know so well and people we have really intimate connection with? I know it's a hard one.
No, it's two things are coming to mind. One of them, sticking with the feet in people's shoes metaphor, thinking about my wife, Kate. What happens when my fight, flight, or need to be right shows up is my foot slides out of her shoe and I'm actually not standing in her reality at all, right? I'm standing on the other side. And so I'm not with. And then the other dynamic is that I live with Kate. I spend more time with Kate than anybody, any other human being on the planet. And so I sometimes make the false assumption that I could describe her world as she sees it, when in reality I can't. Because it's her world. And even though we share lots of air and physical space together and a kid and all of this other context, right? I don't know what the world is like through her eyes, through her lens, but sometimes I make the mistake of thinking that I do. And then the last thing that's showing up for me right now is, Will and I, you know, talk about the spectrum of knowing to learning. Right. So I think as we get taller and older, we know more stuff usually, right? We usually don't learn less stuff as we go on. We usually like accumulate knowledge throughout our life. And when we accumulate more knowledge, it shifts us from a mindset perspective into a mindset of knowing. I know a lot of stuff. And so I'm excited to offer this stuff to somebody else, as opposed to be on the other end of the spectrum with this really deeply rooted in the mindset of learning, which like, yeah, okay, fine. I know stuff. I've been alive for 70 years. I haven't been alive for 70 years, but some people have been alive for 70 years. And that's they've racked up a lot of knowledge, but to be able to make the choice to say, just for a minute, I'm going to set aside that lifetime of ungoogleable experience filled with knowledge and just be curious about that person. And I don't know if Will share this with you, but one of the things that he said about his relationship that's always really stuck with me is when he realizes he stops being curious about Heather, that is when his relationship is dead. It's over right then. Not permanently over, but there is no growth in the relationship. It's stagnated.
I'm going to pull that quote. I'm going to pull that quote. Right? Go ahead.
That's perfect.
Yeah. I'm surprised you didn't share that. Didn't come up. Cause I think that's a compelling realization that he's had that has allowed me that quote or that idea has allowed me to pull my amygdala out of the need to be right multiple times, where I'm like, all I want to do is stand in my own reality and say, you're wrong. This doesn't make sense. Let's do it this way. Whatever the common reaction is. And is right before, or maybe right after I say that and fumbled and screwed up in some way, which is the more likely option actually. Right after that happens, I get to pause and say, okay, whoa. What am I curious to know about how Kate's experience is going right now? And to be honest, if Kate was sitting here next to me listening to this podcast, she'd probably be like, yeah, you have some improvement that you could work on. It was like the irony of our own expertise too, right? Like teach people this and work with, you know, organizations and people all around the world helping with this. And we still need to practice it every single day and screw it up most days too.
Yeah, I'd love to hear more about this also in a work context. So how do we approach that as a leader, as a team member?
I think it was a previous client or customer. One of our card decks was from the Netherlands. I want to say Netherlands. I need to fact check this after the fact. But in Dutch, I believe the word curiosity translates a little bit. And this is actually multiple cultures. Relates somewhat similarly to nosiness. And so at work, the dynamic that most commonly comes up or the objection to connection in a workplace is, wait. This is work. We can't be curious about each other and each other's lives. And to that, I would say like, too bad, like that person is their life. They brought it into work with them. There is not a separation. And I think we've been educated on that in the last 2 years, when there have been lots of kids showing up in the background and cats and UPS people delivering packages and all of that, right? All of that context in life. So in a work context, that said, if you can imagine in your mind a bell curve, the classic, you know, you have your outliers on each corner, but most people, right, fit into a bucket. I think that the impact and value of connection at work lies on a bell curve. And I don't have like, this is the data to show this. It's anecdotal experience working with clients where there's a certain level of connection that's really optimal. But then there, I've also worked with organizations that have gone like way far, and they, you know, they refer to their work culture as family, which can be charged for some people because some people don't have really great families and they're like, I go to work to get away from my family or whatever, right? Whatever that dynamic is. And so certain level of curiosity. And I think that's where intention comes in, is what's your intention in this curiosity? Is it just to like mine me for all of my resources and leave me like an empty quarry? Or is it to uplift and build and be on my team and create communication shortcuts and get to know each other better so that we can actually work better and have a little bit more fun and joy along the way too?
So I want to go into intention, and I want to deliver on the promise here that we're going to talk about the neuroscience, because this is fascinating to me. And I know that I can personally experience a shift when there's a clear intention. And I know that in working with others, that seems like there can almost be this thing, like, I don't get it. Or that's not, you know, it's more like, you got to get down to work, stop with all this intention building, right? But the science behind what's actually happening in the brain when we approach a moment, and as you said, that moment could be a conversation, it could be a meeting, it could be anything. It could be me picking up my daughter from the airport. It could be whatever it is. What's happening in the brain when we're pausing to set an intention?
Yeah, I think soon we'll have, there's little sections in the book with little gray callouts that unpack for each level of this pyramid, unpack some of the neuroscience. And soon we'll actually have these up on the website as well. But one of them is when we set an intention, we're actually much more likely to follow through with that behavior. So this isn't so much what's happening directly in the brain, but it's what's what happens in our. So I don't know that any neuroscientist, right? That's a really sexy word to throw around when you're talking about research or sharing data with a group. But I'll never forget, I had a cognitive psychology professor in grad school. Open up classes. First statement was, just so you know, I'm about to teach an entire semester on the brain. And to be clear, there isn't a single neuroscientist or cognitive scientist who could tell you what a thought actually is. Right? Like, we have some major gaps in understanding in how the brain works. And so most neuroscientists, like, we think this like kind of happens, and then maybe this is sort of the result. Like that's a neuroscientist would probably disagree with me and be like, no, I know more than that. But if you boil it down and you ask why enough times, like our understanding stops. That said, when we set an intention, we know that people are much more likely to follow through with that action. So to the objection of like, hey, we just got to get down to work, we don't have time for this connection thing, because most people in a work context too have feel like they have too much to do in too little time. And so the idea of spending 5 or 10 minutes doing a little bit of connection before content beforehand, which I have a very particular definition for that does not include like little chit chat, small talk, which is normally what connection before content is like, how was your weekend? And just little like fluttery things that people are debatably curious about. So in other words, spending 60 seconds at the beginning of a meeting to say, what is our intention for this meeting, is very likely to increase the chances that that intention actually comes to fruition, comes to life in some way. So that's one major thing, that just setting an intention actually changes people's behavior, which is pretty cool to think about. Yeah.
It almost seems like that intention is guiding where everyone's attention goes.
Yeah. I think the beyond being a really cool play on words, intention very drastically shapes people's attention. Because if they're paying, let's just give people the benefit of the doubt and say that they are paying attention for the first 5 minutes of any conversation or gathering. If after about 5 minutes, they are questioning whether or not intentions are shared or they're ambiguous about what the purpose or intention is, it is really, really likely that their intention will go, or their attention will go somewhere else. They'll start paying their attention to somebody else if that intention or that pathway isn't clear, which I think, you know, we don't need to talk about that almost in the third person. That's probably true for us. If we're in a conversation and we're like, I don't know that this is exactly what I expected. Like there have been times, not so much anymore, but when I first started We and Me, where I would hop on a call with somebody or a potential client or a client, and be getting 5 minutes in, I'd be like, whoa, like I need more context on this. Like, what is happening right now? It can be jarring to not have a shared intention or purpose, even if somebody like really wants to get down to work.
And I think actually, even with this podcast, like I had an intention of where I wanted to go. And then it's like, I got distracted, but because it was clear and I'd said it, I could find my way back. Right. Because this visual came to my mind as you were talking about that. It's almost like playing pin the tail on the donkey with a blindfold or without a blindfold. You know, and if you're playing the game and you've got the blindfold on, right, the tail could end up any old place, right? And we've all played that as a kid and seen the incredibly funny things that happen as a result of that, very often not hitting the target, right? You take the blindfold off and it's much easier to put the tail. And, you know, I mean, not that creative things can't come from seeing what happens when you put a tail on the nose of the donkey butt or something like that. But, you know, in general, in our environments, when we talk about efficiency, if we have no intention and we're doing this all with blindfolds on, it ends up as so much less efficient a process in the long run.
Yeah, that metaphor is perfect, right? It's like seeing where you're going versus running around with a blindfold on. And to maybe, I'm in me and Will's partnership and relationship, I'm the one that always wants to... Will's really, really amazing at focusing on who somebody is being rather than what they're doing. And he just has some gift to access many invisible things in a dynamic conversation, which I'd like to think I can do some of. But I'm also the person that leads a conversation. I'm like, what do I do with my hands? So that I love that idea and metaphor. And to take it even one step further into like, okay, so how do I take off the blindfold beyond just share an intention? Because that's a pretty broad call to action, actually. And so in the book, we break down a few different intentions. Two of them that I think might be useful right now to put this into practice. One of them is an outcome-focused intention, right? So by the end of this meeting, I would love to have all of these details decided so that nobody leaves with any extra work to do. Right. The so that is really important because the first part of what I said is almost an objective or an agenda item. Like we want to get this done, the outcome. Adding the words so that to the end of any sentence, and you can do it multiple times, actually make a really long sentence. But when you add so that, it takes it one level deeper or more expansive and allows that intention to include the needs of others. Whereas if I'm, let's say I'm boss and I say, hey, let's get started. We need to get this done. That's great. I want to get it done. That's my need. But a really good intention should encompass the people who are going to help me out, their needs as well. And so to say, let's get this done so that everybody can leave with nothing to do and maybe some extra time to spend with family, right? It's a really empathetic way to say, let's get down to work. And very sincere too. So outcome focus intention being one. On the other aspect, and I really like this one for no matter what context you're in, but it's a commitment focused intention. So one that is useful for me, even like I mentioned to you before we started recording that I haven't, I'm interviewing somebody for the role of director of connections for We and Me. And I have a very bad habit, despite liking questions and helping Will write a book about it. I have a very bad habit of talking too much in an interview and like sharing, because I get excited. I'm like, oh, I'm bringing this person to the world, blah, blah, blah. I need to like slow my roll. And so let's just say this. Let's put this into practice. At 3 p.m. today, when I am interviewing Heather, my intention will be to listen more than I share and to really listen in a way that's uplifting her, rather than listening to like check boxes and see if she fits or not for this interview. There we go.
Beautiful.
So commitment focus, as a leader, if you make a commitment focus intention to somebody, it allows your peeps to kind of keep you in check too, to say like, hey, remember how you had kind of spelled out this intention? I'm not sure that's happening right now.
So it's almost like there's the difference between what we want to do and how we want to be, right? How do I want to be in this interaction with Heather versus what do I want to get done?
Yeah. Yep. Yep. I would say that the two usually create a pretty good split. I would say there's a nuance you can, you could say an outcome focus intention. You know, say you're having a 2-day conference. The intention of this conference is for all of us to leave being and feeling uplifted. I don't know why that word keeps showing up for me right now in this conversation, but so it's, you can have an outcome actually be related to being as well. It doesn't necessarily need to be a to-do list item.
One of the things, and then we're going to, we have so much to cover, but again, we're not going to make this a 5-hour conversation, but what I'm thinking about intentions, and we've talked about the fact that they do help to focus and we take off the blindfold. We actually say, I want to look, I want to really kind of set myself in the direction of, I want all of us, if there's a group of us, to be, you know, agreeing upon and directed toward a way of being as well as possibly an outcome. And then in the book, you talk about how a single word can change an intention completely. And there's, I'm sure you have many examples. Like there's an example you give in there about Hewlett-Packard and the work they're doing. And you also talk about one time where there was this experience where Will, instead of saying create conversations that matter, is create conversations that create matter. And yes. Talking about that. And I want to just spend some time, because I know that when I work with people, I can sometimes really bring their attention to a single word. Most of us are not super vigilant about the word choices we make. And so what difference can a single word make in making connection or setting intention?
Yeah, I just learned something from your question, which is cool and an insight that I have not had before this moment. So I'm excited to share that. The first thing that comes up, I had a mentor and friend, Brenton, who always used to say, and I think his mentor said this, and I'm sure that somebody before that said this too, but this idea that a choice of words is often a choice of worlds. Mm-hmm. That is true. And also what you said is true, in that we often don't think too much about our words. We let them flow out, especially us extroverts, right? We don't take enough time to process. The aha, or the insight that came from your question in both the examples from Hewlett-Packard and from Will's keynote, which, just for context, the Hewlett-Packard, the short story is that there was a big vision meeting happening for Hewlett-Packard to kind of cast a vision of where are we going? What kind of company do we want to be? And essentially, they had written up on a whiteboard in this brainstorming session, we want to be the best computer company in the world. And there was a senior engineer on the team who was like, I'm not totally, like, that doesn't make me want to get out of bed in the morning. Like, okay, cool. Microsoft makes computers too. So rewinding, senior engineer in this meeting gets up and goes to the whiteboard, crosses out the word in, we're going to be the best computer company in the world, and writes the word for above it. We want to be the best computer company for the world. And as part of research for this book, I actually contacted and got in touch with somebody who was in that meeting that happened. The ripple effect of that meeting was that phrase, we want to be the best computer company for the world, right, turned a more of like a lame business objective or vision into a really powerful intention in one word shift. That ended up becoming a poster of a picture of the world. And this is like back before Photoshop even, picture of the world in the founder's shed. And that was printed and shared with hundreds of thousands of people around the world within HP, et cetera. One word shift, really different sentence. That word shift also, and I don't have data on this, but I guarantee that that word shift changed retention rates on teams, because to work for the best computer company for the world versus the best one in the world are two very different experiences. One has tied to a higher level purpose and intention. One is like, we just want to make a little bit more cash. So for me, yeah, that is the power of one single word. The aha, though, is in the example of Will misspeaking the subtitle of the book and saying conversations that create matter rather than conversations, creating conversations that matter, is those are both, but the HP thing and that were both things, right? They were statements. One was like a vision statement. One was a subtitle of a book. It wasn't just a random sentence that somebody was randomly saying in a random conversation. And so I wonder if it takes, if we want to get really intentional about our words, if it actually takes writing it out and giving it a name, whether it's a vision statement or at the beginning of a meeting, an intent statement, or a subtitle or a title or something like that, like name those words that you're going to be sharing. Because I think when we do, we elevate their purpose. Like this sentence is more, or this phrase is more important than all the other ones that will happen today that will go out of our mouth or into our ears. So that's kind of fun to think about. If you have some words that you want to make more impactful, give it a name, make it a thing, and maybe put it on a poster. I don't know.
It's interesting because we do put a lot more intention and take more care when we're doing things like creating a vision statement or the subtitle in a book or things like that. Yet it's interesting how many times you might hear from somebody, you know, that thing you said to me 10 years ago that you didn't even realize had an impact left an impression that has stayed with a person, or a glance that we made at somebody has stuck with them and meant something either harmful or wonderful. And I recently started a blog post that just caused us to perhaps get curious, is what if we had to actually pay a tax or a surcharge on every word we wrote or spoke? Would we do what we sometimes do? Would we let everything just flow in as mindless a way as we sometimes can? Would we post all over the internet every which thing that came to our mind? And bringing that consciousness to how impactful in almost any context every word that we might speak could be.
I love that. And to give that a name of it, friend Solomon, who helped in the co-creation of We Connect cards. And he talked about, or he loves talking about the economy of words. And that concept, exactly right. Like it's a pretty brain shifting idea to say that, you know, you're charged 1/100th of a cent for every word that you say today.
You know, what's interesting about that, you know, the neuroscience behind that, which is there are two different brain processes happening, one when you're creating and one when you're editing. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think we have, you know, both and here, you know, there has to be an opportunity for us to just articulate wildly and then a different process for, let's refine that. And that's in essence, it seems to me, what that engineer at HP did. You know, someone articulated something and he began that editing process, that analysis of, you know, what really works about this and what doesn't.
Ooh, so many insights showing up. So imagine this, Aiming. Imagine start a meeting. Let's say there's 10 people there and you take 60 seconds and ask everybody to type their intention for that meeting into the chat. that's the divergent thinking part of a creative process, right? Like, be free with your words. Don't feel limited in any way. Feel free to word vomit on your keyboard. Then pause, read through everybody's intentions. And knowing everybody else's intentions, can you copy and paste your own and add so that, and then an additional statement that you feel like encompasses everybody else's intention, right? To expand that intention out a little bit. Something like that. That's fun. That's cool. That's also important to realize, because if I was thinking about being charged for all of my words, I'd have the same level of hyper-consciousness that I do when I shut off the lights or I leave a light on. And I'm like, that was like $2.87 leaving that attic light on all week, or whatever it was. And so you want people to have a certain level of freedom in speaking and not to feel like, and I think that this is an interesting conversation to talk about too, is in the culture of political correctness that we live in, what's the balance or the continuum of how many eggshells do we walk on versus how okay are we stepping on an eggshell and saying, oops, can you tell me more about why that's an eggshell? And learning. And I don't have a real strong opinion one way or the other, but I know now that there kind of is a tax on our words, organizationally especially, right? And the tax is you might end up in HR if you say the wrong thing, or if you're in an interview, you might not get a job, right? There are actually lots of contexts where your words are taxed, just in sometimes non-monetary ways.
I don't know. Can we stick some onto Facebook or Twitter or something like that? I think we could raise a lot of money for something good in the world if we did that. All right, off my soapbox. Just had to say that. So the first line, we've been talking about the first part of the pyramid, and we're not going to get all the way up to the top because otherwise, again, this would be our 5-hour conversation. But in terms of intention moving up to rapport and that making that connection, I often think of the work that we do at Courage to Be Curious focuses on reflection, and you guys work on connection, you know, like bringing that reflection to really self-awareness and awareness of self in relationship to others. And then you guys pick up that work and how do we then bring forth connection? So, but I want to think about the role of curiosity in making connection. You've used this word a lot. And let's say we're all born with it, right? We all have the sense we're born with it. And when we're kids, we're running around with certain kinds of curiosity. It's what we naturally come out of the womb with. And what happens to that curiosity, or what makes it so important to the connection process? And then what happens to it over time? Where does it go?
Yeah, I know this might not be a common narrative for everyone, but in my own world, it feels like a common narrative that it's like, we're really, really curious. We're really wonderfully curious little beings. We're asking, from all the research we did, asking roughly 300 to 400 questions per day when we're ages 2 to 5. And then by the time we're adults, we ask on average 6 to 12 questions per day. And, from being around adults and being an adult, probably half of those questions are like, when are you getting home and what are we going to eat tonight? And right, this is like logistical questions, not necessarily curiosity, questions rooted in curiosity. So what happens to it? The common narrative that I feel like is that we blame school and we say, really curious. And then we go to school and people teach you the right answer to a test and you're like searching for the right answer. And I think that is, one of my teachers used to say that the best way to kill a question is with an answer. And I think that is a perfect way to kill that question. It's just to blame school or to blame education or blame anything else. And I think that with most things in life, there is not a super like, this is why, or this is where our curiosity goes. It's like, it's actually in Montana. Our curiosity went to Montana, right? It's like, there isn't that simple of an answer. So maybe school is part of it, depending on the teachers that you had. I think that one dynamic, going back to an earlier part of the conversation, is as our knowledge accumulates, we kill more and more questions. So let's say there's a billion potential questions we could ask within our realm of knowledge and our little lives on Earth. So there's a billion potential questions. And as we get older, we keep crossing them out as we find answers to them. And so when Otto, my son, asked me, why is the red light red? And I say, it's so that cars stop and don't crash into each other. Whoosh, cross, or more likely, why gets added on, and we cross out 17 more questions that are follow-ups to that. But if you think about it, like, I don't think we're ever going to get near close to crossing off a billion, but our brains can't actually comprehend a billion. So when we cross off about 10,000 questions, let's say, as we grow up and understand the world more, that feels like there's less questions to be asked because we've asked so many of them. We understand so much around the world. And so I wonder if our curiosity is actually just sitting in the basement with the other 999,999,000, et cetera, questions that we haven't asked yet. So I don't know. Truly, I don't know the answer, but I think that those are two variables that play into the curiosity deficit or our curiosity going away. Because I do agree that largely it's gone away.
You know, this makes me wonder, and we're not going to answer this today, but, you know, it makes me wonder about the nature of understanding. You know, what makes us decide, okay, we know? You know, what is the nature of that? So we'll leave that for the neuroscientists, but or the philosophers. But it's, you know, it makes me curious. At what point do we say, okay, check, you know, is there something going on in our brains that makes us feel like I have full understanding of this and need go no further? I don't know.
I think this is one of the most profoundly interesting things that is 99% of our awareness never even travels down this path, but it is. With any scientific discovery, if you ask why just a couple times, a couple layers down, the smartest physicists, aerospace scientists, neuroscientists, et cetera, have no answers. Like literally just a couple layers deep. So, okay, so oxytocin floods our brain. We feel more love. We know that we hug somebody for 14 seconds. Oxytocin gets released. But so why does oxytocin get released? Okay, a hug. Why does like skin touching skin release oxytocin? That does it like oxytocin's in our brain, but skin's over, like, right? So just a couple, and people smarter than me can go a couple layers down, but there's pretty quickly you hit a ceiling where someone, if they're really honest, is going to say,
I mean, it's all about the species surviving and continuing, you know, it's all about self preservation, I think, ultimately.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, right. Do we really need to know, like, the fact that all my skin cells in my hand are stuck together and they're not floating off into space? Do I really need to walk around the world knowing why that is? Or do I just need to pick up my coffee so I can drink it in the morning? And it's like, yeah, maybe as you move up Maslow's hierarchy, like, you might think about that, but you don't really need to know it in order to operate in life. And so, yeah, that's probably why yeah, it's probably useful to our survival to not think about that 99% of the time. Yeah.
There was a phrase that you just used at the very end of that exchange where you said operate in life. And that combined with something that your previous comment or discussion kind of led me down this path of what is the purpose of our curiosity? And when might we actually start to interpret that the purpose of our curiosity is to gather enough information to be able to operate in life as though that is the end goal of it. In which case, then I only need to get curious enough to accumulate what I believe I need to operate in a particular situation. And I was thinking about it because when you talked about your son asking you about why the light is red, and you answered as I absolutely probably answered the same question to my daughters, which was, you know, to because people can stop and we can travel safely. And then I thought to myself, if I had been trained differently then, if I thought about this, and if the goal was not to give information to help us operate in life, but the goal was actually to keep cultivating curiosity, how else might I have responded? And I thought to myself, I wonder what might have happened in my own kids' development if I had responded in that moment. What do you notice happening each time the light turns red? Mm. You know, and if I had continued to set my kids on a path of engaging their own investigation rather than filling the blank of an answer, which I didn't do, by the way. And I noticed the impact on my own kids because I didn't do that then. And I also noticed the impacts in my own life. There's a plate, there's certain places, like to your point, okay, we might be an expert in this, but it doesn't mean we've got it all figured out and we do it all the time. You know, there are places where I recognize that my curiosity is my default go-to. And then I realize there are places where the answers and the filling in the information needing to know is where I go to. And, you know, as you were talking, I think that just sort of got me a little curious is our curiosity for the function of being able to operate, or, you know, is that curiosity, same as in A Curious Mind? Tell me the author of A Curious Mind, who I'm blanking on right now.
Ryan Grazer,
right. You know, is it simply for its own purpose? And as you know, I think it's attributed right to Albert Einstein, curiosity is its own reason for existing, right? So it's just what prompted my thinking.
So here's a very in this very moment, when you ask that question, what, you know, what's the purpose of curiosity? I notice I'm looking at myself on, or peeked down on myself on camera, and I just had this huge grin on my face in this conversation. And we're a little bit after the top of the hour. And to be honest, I came in with the intention of like, I have a little bit of like six dumpster fires going on in my life outside of this and work, and there's a basement flooding. And so I was like, I'm going to get off. Like, this is going to be a shortish podcast and I'm going to get off. And I found myself just sitting here smiling. And and then you ask that question, what's the purpose of curiosity? And my whole being and my gut just went to create joy. Like it, when you're really curious right now, my wife woke up an hour and a half ago. I was on the phone with her and she's like, you sound really stressed. You should just like hang up with me and go meditate, which I did before we hopped on here. And, but just the aha here, like I'm relearning, like I know this, I knew this, but I'm relearning that really genuine curiosity, which by the way, I attribute Amy and Adina to, like your absolute brilliance in curiosity. You should have written, asked powerful questions. You're just really, really, you know, phenomenal askers and listeners. And so, and the result of that for me right now is joy. So this is just a major gift. Thank you.
Well, I think that is a beautiful transition to how we typically wrap these up. Like, let's leave each other with doses of joy, because I think as we shared before we got on, one of the things we like to leave with is let's just ask questions that are genuinely curious about to each other. And I'm going to imagine that we ask those questions today, that what we're doing is we're making up offerings of joy to each other in asking those questions. And I will say Amy is actually quite spectacular at this activity and asks questions that every single time make me burst into that smile. And so, Amy, I'm going to let you begin the activity today because you are so spectacular at this.
Oh, you're so kind. So, Chad, I am curious. You mentioned the word uplift a few times today, and you even noticed that you used that word a few times. And so what is it about uplift that made it worth mentioning today?
I probably need to meditate after this conversation in order to answer that. But I think... my wife's coming up a lot in conversation today too, but, naturally we're married and we talk about, work and each other's days often enough. And, sometimes that feels like I'm almost like sharing about my day because that's what we like, that's what you do over dinner. But the other night, sometimes, right? But the other night she was listening in a way that the conversation didn't sound that different, but it felt so different. And I think there was a certain level of, I felt very uplifted. And I think the reason may have been Kate's intention, right? Just really, really there. But there was also this, it was like the third type of intention that we didn't talk about is a future focus intention. And I could feel there was this like desire to create a really brilliant future in this conversation in the present moment. And so I think uplifting, I don't know if it's like just a vertical, like up lift. I think it's also like a lift forward towards something else. Like you're actually helping someone go somewhere, wherever that is they want to go, whether that's to a more joyful place, or just to the next step in their career, or to get unstuck from where they are, whatever that is, just that forward motion, partially sparked by the future focus intention of listening, you know, listening in a way that changes what people say and what people actually do.
It almost sounds like it's one of your core values, right? To uplift and feel that, what that feels like when you're doing that. Tell me where I'm wrong.
No. My my confused look or my face was actually saying, you know, this morning, as I'm thinking about hiring this person, I'm thinking about, you know, we have values that are written down in a variety of places. But if I were to just really quickly say, here's our values, what would those be? And I think you might be right. That my intention is absolutely to uplift the leaders and educators that I get to work with.
Awesome.
Do I get Beautiful. To go next, yes. Adina, or how does this work?
Yes, go ahead. You get to go next. Ask somebody a question.
So one of my favorite questions that's not on WeConnect cards, and I'm actually genuinely curious about this because I don't know a ton about your world outside of this podcast, Adina. And so I know some, I don't know a ton. And so I'm wondering what has been in the last, let's bring it to recent times. So in the last week or two, you could scale it out into August if you want to think about the month. What has been a highlight, a low light, and an insight for you in the last month?
Oh, okay. Well, I'll start with low light. We'll get that out of the way. So the low light has been, I think I've shared with both of you that my mom has been pretty sick. And actually, according to research, that what she has, which is postherpetic neuralgia complication after shingles, is categorized as literally the number two most painful thing that a body can experience. And it's only behind number one, which is a similar ailment, but from a different disease.
Oh, wow.
And so I have been, you know, watching her for the last week go into episodes of just excruciating torture pain. And you're just able to sit with somebody you love and just hold them while they experience it. So that has been really, really painful. And I would say that's probably the low. I would say, you know, the powerful thing that is related to that is I have a dear friend, a best friend who literally became like almost an adopted sister. But how often that you have a friend who will actually come in, because I don't typically live close to my mom. As you know, Chad, I moved out to the other side of Pennsylvania. And so I live 6 hours away from where my mother is right now, except now I live with her. But before I got here, to have a friend who's willing to step in and say, I will be you, and I will go, and I will be there and hold your mother, and I will take her to the emergency room, and I will do all of these things, you know, in your place.
That is a wild gift.
That is a wild, wild gift. So, you know, to talk about a highlight, you know, of those two things. And I remember one of the teachers that I always, teachings I value most from somebody was to say how humans can hold two totally competing emotions at the same time. And so you can have such deep sadness and such deep gratitude and, you know, feeling that you've received such a deep gift at the same time in the same moment. So that's been wonderful. And, you know, I think that insight of what I've been thinking a lot about, I guess we'll say, is the human experience and what is it that makes something a life? And when, you know, who gets to determine what, you know, what makes life meaningful and what makes it, you know, what makes us able to be present to it? So I don't know that I have an insight, but it's the things I've been sitting with this week. So
sounds like sitting with them is insightful in and of itself, actually. I think you start your first question of our conversation was, what's a conversation that matters? How is that broken down? And I can see that that's actually sometimes insight, right? You're just sitting with it. But maybe partially because you've been sitting with that, it became the first question that started off our conversation in a really lovely way. So it's fun to think about insights and just pondering. Actually, this is where Will talking about conversations that create matter, right? You just actually change the course of our history. I don't know about all of history, but you just change the course of our history by sitting with that. So thanks.
Well, thank you. And Amy, let me ask you a quick question tonight. Just because I have to, I am so curious. You know, you always have these cool backgrounds on when we're doing these shows, but they always have flowers. So tell us something about your relationship to flowers, because every background you have has flowers in it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's my relationship to beauty and growth and, you know, things that are just absolutely astonishing. Like, this exists. Like, there's an organism on this earth that can create these purple leaves and also have a fragrance. This happens to be the wisteria vines growing in my outdoor shower. So this is what I see when I'm taking a shower. And so, yeah, it's about bringing beauty, which really, you know, sounds kind of, I don't know, trite, but for me, I'm realizing how important that is to me. You know, I was thinking when you were talking about highlights, you know, the highlights of my life are always looking out my window into my garden and seeing something growing there, or seeing a hummingbird outside my window. Just those simple moments of beauty that bring me as much joy as Chad gets out of his curiosity.
So I think almost more than anything, this conversation, I felt it a lot, which is just, wow, the power of questions. I mean, I ask questions all day long. I know Chad, you do too. And Amy, and sometimes you have moments where you just like are reminded, this is why I love this work, right? This is why this work is so powerful. And today's conversation is one of those. And so, you know, Chad, you guys have a whole collection of resources to help engage people, help them learn how to ask conversations that matter, how to create conversations that matter, how to ask questions that connect. So share some of those resources so people know where they can find out more.
Yeah, sure. Before I share that, I'll share a resource that I didn't create. I can't remember the guy's name, but based on what you just said about flowers and plants and that small joy, Amy, there's a new documentary called Fantastic Fungi. And I think it's Lou somebody who does amazing time-lapse photography of mushrooms and plants. And I just saw like a behind the scenes of how he filmed that. It was just so remarkable to bend perspective of time and see that beauty all, you know, condensed. Something that takes, yeah, you know what a time lapse is. Okay. So Connection Toolkit is this really lovely box that has a ton of awesome stuff packed into it. So including the book, cards, etc. And I think information should be free, and experiences and actual like things you can touch is how I feed my family and pay a mortgage. And so if you go to weand.me/ideas, so weand.me/ideas, you can get a free digital version of that Connection Toolkit or a whole bunch of free resources. And then on that same website, you can check out the actual physical Connection Toolkit, books, etc. If you Google Chad Littlefield, you'll find a Chad Littlefield who was murdered a few years ago. It's not me. I'm still here. So add we and me to the end of that Google search and you'll find a whole bunch of other stuff too. You can do the same on YouTube. I have, you know, a couple hundred videos. All of the videos titles, most of the video titles are actually a question, and the video is my best response to that question. So an actual question that a leader or an educator asked me in some way, shape or form. Yeah, there you go. Weand.me.
Weand.me. And so we hope, as we do every single week on this podcast, that we inspire your own curiosity as a listener, that we inspire you to explore what it means to show up to life, to relationships, to leadership from a stance of curiosity, and to really expand your repertoire in asking questions. So you've got great resources, Courage to be curious. This is why we produce question cards too. Let's all go out and create more curiosity together. And this was such an amazing finale to the month on the power of questions through September. So thank you, Chad. And thank you, Amy, for making this such an incredible experience.
Thank you.
And we will be back in October, where we are talking about facades and the masks that we wear in the world and how we take them off and what happens when we do. So keep listening with us. We are back in October, and I just hope we keep connecting, keep creating connections and conversations that matter with both of you.
Absolutely. I would love that. Chad, it was a great experience to be in your orbit today.
Yeah, this is a joy, Amy and Dina. Thanks for sparking the conversation and asking the questions that made it happen.
Awesome. And we will be back with you next week.